Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service in Geneva at the UN here for our last briefing of the year 2025. I would like to give immediately the floor to our first speaker, who has been brought by Eugene. We have the pleasure to have with us Brigitte Mukanga-Ino, who is the UNHCR representative in Burundi. Madam, you're joining from Bujumbura. And to tell us about the violences in Eastern DRC. You want to start, Eugene, and then we give the floor to Beatrice. To Beatrice.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining today's briefing. I'm bringing our representative in Burundi, but first of all, let me just highlight the escalating violence in South Kivu in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Already displaced 500,000 Congolese internally. And you will hear more about those who cross the border to Burundi and then their dire humanitarian situation. And if you have any question on the situation in DRC, I'm happy to answer after the briefing of our representative. Representative, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. As you just stated, the escalation of violence in the Eastern Congo, particularly in South Kivu, started around end of beginning of this December, and since then we have received here in Burundi, the government of Burundi, UNHCR, and other humanitarian partners, we have received as of yesterday evening more than 84,000 new arrivals, and this is the highest influx that Burundi is experiencing. You would remember that at the beginning of the year already, following the crisis in Goma and Bukavu, Burundi received over 70,000 people then, plus those who have been living in the country. So currently Burundi is receiving over 200,000 Congolese refugees. This is quite high for the capacities here in Burundi, which is quite limited. We have seen over the past few days and this escalation and the increased number of people who are crossing into Burundi, many of them who are coming by foot, but also as the fight has continues going down, we started receiving first those from the northern part of Burundi at the border with Kamanyola. That was the first group that came this early December. And close to 30,000 of them were put in a site, which is just across Kamanyola. And then as the flight was evolving toward Uvira, we started also receiving a new border area, which is Gatumba. So around Gatumba, we have more than 25,000 people who have been received from there. And for the past few days, as the fight continues on the side of Fizi and Baraka, which is exactly opposite Rumonge on the Burundi side. So on that side, people are coming through by using boats. And some of these boats are just in very bad conditions. And one of them actually capsized 2 days ago, creating some people who were drowned. The refugees who are arriving are very much exhausted. Many of them, after working for many days before reaching Burundi, both women, children, elderly people, and most vulnerable people who are crossing, they are coming really in a very exhausted condition for working for days, but also some of them are telling us that they have been living already in internally displaced camps inside Congo. And for those ones, they are bringing actually even some of their torn tents that they are putting upon arrival in Burundi. But it's still very difficult. The conditions, living conditions are very bad. We are in raining season here in Burundi, and without the necessary shelters, we don't have the shelters as the situation is evolving to provide for this for the new arrival. And that is exposing people actually to even harsh condition, weather condition. We have started observing cases of cholera, which have been declared and confirmed by the Ministry of Health. And in fact, this afternoon, we are having another meeting on the cholera outbreak, which is being observed in most of the sites where refugees are being established. The government has provided a new site, which is away from the borders with the DRC, so that the new refugees can be established in the new site. The site is in the eastern part of Burundi. It's called Buero in Ruigi province. And so we have started the relocation of the refugees to the new site. So far, about 21,000 people have been already transferred to Buero sites, but even the site itself is still under development, is still lacking the essential services that the refugees need as they arrive at the site. So on 2 days ago, on the 17th, this December, the government of Burundi, through the Ministry of Interior, and the humanitarian coordinator and all UN agencies launched an international call for solidarity for the response to this humanitarian situation. So there's an appeal that has been launched for the value of 35 million US dollars, which would try to help to provide the necessary protection and assistance to the new arrival into Burundi. And as my colleague Eugene just said, apart from those who are coming into Burundi, we are seeing a large displacement, internal displacement on the Congo side. And in our coordination meetings with colleagues in Congo, they are telling us that indeed there's a large number of over 500,000 new displacement inside Congo. The other thing we have seen with the refugees, particularly those who are in the Gatumba area, some of them would like to return as soon as possible, hoping that the discussion that is taking place, the various negotiations in Congo, hoping that that would yield some results so that they can return as soon as possible, because this, most of them are people who have been government workers and traders, etc., who would like to go back. Meanwhile, for those who came from the rural areas and who have been already in IDP camps, many of them are saying that they don't feel that they can return now. They are still hesitant because of the many displacements they have been going through before this current situation. Generally, for Burundi, the situation is quite overwhelming. The number of refugees in Burundi is quite high compared to the capacity of the country, the services which are not available, the outbreak of disease that is coming up with this emergency. We really need support. We need resources in order to put up the necessary shelter and provide assistance. As I was saying, it is raining season, and people living just in the open, the health condition is deteriorating quite fast, and we need support from everyone. Thank you so much. We would like to stop here and remain available. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Brigitte, for this update, important update. I am opening the floor to questions now in the room. Any hands up? No. Online, I see Emma Farge, Reuters. Emma, good morning.
Hi, good morning. A few questions, please. You used the word overwhelming for Burundi. What is your appraisal of the government's patience with this situation? Do you think there's any risk of them closing the border if they don't get the support? And a couple of clarifications. Why can you not get the adequate shelter? Is it funding or logistics or both? And secondly, you mentioned 500,000 internally displaced within Congo. Since when have those people been displaced, please? Thank you.
Brigitte.
Yes, overwhelming is because Burundi itself is having another pressure with the return of Burundians who are coming from Tanzania, but also other neighboring countries. And recently, there was a tripartite meeting with the government of Tanzania, Burundi, and UNHCR, during which Tanzania clearly stated that they have to accelerate the return of Burundians. And we have been receiving thousands of Burundians who are returning as well. And the resources in the country are not, Burundi is having its own economic challenges. So the capacity to absorb both the large number of returnees and the Congolese refugees, the capacity is quite limited. The services are not available. That's why for the refugees at least, the humanitarian community, the international the appeal, the flash appeal that was launched is going to help to support the refugees, but also the host communities so that we can avoid clashes over the limited resources that are available in the country. The risk of closing the border, yes, the borders are already officially closed, but they just left a kind of corridor to allow the refugees, the people who are fleeing from Congo to come into Burundi. But officially, the borders are already closed at Gatumba. The funding is really the major issue here. Both UNHCR and other humanitarian actors, we have been experiencing a very difficult financial situation since the beginning of this year. And in 2025 alone, this is the second time Burundi is facing this large influx of refugees. So the resources are overstretched. And yes, that's the main that's why we are not in a position to provide the necessary shelter or even the water or sanitation in these sites, which have been created by the influx. The conditions are really difficult. No sanitation. The number of bladders to provide water is very limited. The queues, the children and women, they are queuing for hours to get some water. Same for the shelter and even the food, WFP is out of resources. So we hope really that with the flash appeal there could be some response as soon as possible because to avoid the condition from going from bad to worse. There was a response from ECHO. We got $3 million. Out of the 35 million requested for the Burundi situation, which has just helped in creating this Bweru site, which is a kind of safety area for people who are running from Congo. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Brigitte. Sorry, you want to add
No, because
something?
I want to answer the last question about DRC
About
displacement.
the 5,000.
Yes, so 500,000, the new displacement inside of DRC is since the 2nd of December, and among them, 200,000 Congolese are in Uvira territory. They are displaced within the Uvira territory. And also remind you that there is currently 5.3 million Congolese internally displaced, and among them, 3.6 million are in the eastern DRC, and also, in addition, 1.1 million Congolese hosted in neighboring country.
Thank you, Eugene. I've seen you've distributed the notes, but these numbers would probably be also very useful if you can share them. Spanish news agency.
Hi, thank you. These days, there has been an announcement that the troops of the M23 were withdrawing from the city of Uvira. I wanted to know if you have teams on the ground that could verify the situation with the current withdrawal, and also if you have testimonies from people that were there and that have left the city. Thank you.
Brigitte?
We are still conducting protection monitoring activities and border monitoring, but on the Burundi side. And so far, the information that we have is only what the refugees can tell us, particularly those who are just coming. As of yesterday and even this morning, we are still receiving some boats with people who are running from the Fizi and the Baraka area in the South Kivu. They are telling us that the fight is still continuing in those areas. It's not the city of Uvira per se, but it's south of Uvira, where Fizi and Baraka, that the fight is still ongoing, and that's why we are still receiving boats every day. As of yesterday evening, there were almost 12 boats with new arrival. So the official information on announcing the withdrawal of M23, maybe that is around the city of Uvira, but in inner land, I think the fight is still ongoing, which is leading to this continuous displacement from those areas.
Thank you very much. I don't see other question for you, Brigitte. Thank you so much. Thanks, Eugene, to be with us today, and thanks to Brigitte for this briefing. Let's remain in Africa and go now to IOM. We have with us, Amanda, maybe you want to introduce yourself, because I think it's the first time you come to the briefing, and introduce your colleague from Port Sudan that I can see has joined, but we know him, but maybe you want to introduce you and him.
Okay. Yeah. Good morning, everyone. I'm glad to be with you here today in this briefing, a very important one indeed on the situation in Sudan, particularly the latest development trends in Darfur and South Kordofan regions. As IOM has communicated in its press materials, these areas in particular continue to experience increasing displacement and, as a result, increasing humanitarian needs, indeed. And I'm pleased to be joined today by my colleague, Dr. Mohamed Rifat, our chief of mission in Sudan, who is going to connect shortly and provide you with the latest displacement figures and humanitarian needs, and also the broader situation on the ground. Without further ado, over to you, Mohamed.
Welcome, Mohamed. Nice to see you again.
No, it's a pleasure always to be with you, and I know it's the end of the year, and my solidarity with colleagues from Burundi as well, and I wish you all good vacation time before I start. I promise I will be very short. I know you have all heard a lot about Sudan, but I really wanted just to join to send a very clear two messages. One of them will focus on Kordofan, and the other is about the returns. But before we start, I just would like to remind everyone that Sudan remains the largest global displacement as we speak now. We still have around 9.3 million internally displaced within Sudan. I remember early this year when I first joined in one of my first briefings this year with you, we were talking around almost 11.9. So we have a little bit of hope here to speak about, and I will come to this point later. But today I'm talking because we are all concerned about what happened in Al-Fashir. On the 25th of October, we all start seeing the horrific videos. We heard about the news of displacement. And we as IOM, through our displacement tracking metrics, has counted more than 109,000 who have managed to flee the city of Al-Fashir and its surrounding villages. Those are still, many of them are still stuck in the neighboring villages, not able to move farther because of logistic security issues that we are all aware about. Unfortunately, we have failed to reach, for many reasons, like ceasefire or peace agreement. And our access remains very challenged, even after the visit of high senior officials of the ERC, Tom Fletcher. We still all have the challenges on seeing and understanding what exactly happened in Al-Fashir. But again, I will not focus today on Al-Fashir, but my first message is about Kordofan and what's happening now in Kordofan. Until now, since the 25th of October, we have seen more and more escalation of hostilities in Kordofan, And we have counted more than 50,000 who have been displaced since the 25th of October from Kordofan alone. And Kordofan, I mean the main states of Kordofan. We have seen this cross-border movement going to South Sudan just between the 4th and the 10th of, 4th, sorry, the 4th and the 15th of this month. We have counted over 3,300 who have crossed to South Sudan. Those displacements from Kordofan are not happening sporadically. They are happening because people are scared. They are fleeing from areas in Baba Nusa, areas around Kadugli, around Al Ubayid. And those are still those who are lucky to flee. And they start arriving in areas in White Nile, in Gadaref. And they are arriving only women and children, which is also alarming about the protection that's the protection issues that's happening in those areas. To put this in numbers, from North Kordofan alone, we counted more than 40,000 IDPs over this the same period I'm talking about. From South Kordofan, almost 10,000 IDPs, and from West Kordofan, around 250. We remain very alarmed by this displacement, not because only of the scale, but what if this becomes the next Al-Fashir? And this is what we need to avoid. We need to avoid through trying to silence the guns, and we need to avoid through our preparedness and being ready on the humanitarian side and protection side mainly. Today, we received a shipment and donation from the Turkish government, more than 30,000 tents. We are seeing more and more non-traditional donors coming. We are seeing support for also from our traditional donors, from the US government, from ECHO, from the EU. But this will never be enough if we see another thousands and hundreds of thousands of displacement. So this is my first message about Kordofan. We have a situation that we need to avoid that escalate into another Al-Fashir. On the return file, as I mentioned earlier, we have more than 2.6 IDPs who opted to return over the last maybe 8-9 months. We have a moment of hope where every month we have seen decline in the number of IDPs within Sudan, but this is also rapidly vanishing. As we have seen people more and more hesitant to return, we have seen attacks on civil infrastructures. Just yesterday or the day before, we have seen big attack on one of the power stations in Atbara. Many of the states have went dark because of these attacks. Now the question that all the population have, is my return safe? Should I return or should I not return? We see in the social media all the news about new attacks in states like Al Jazeera, like Sennar, like Gadaref, even like Tawila, where it hosts 550,000. And we remain very alarmed. And if those attacks materialize, if people get scared again, if they opt to get displaced again, those population will be very hesitant, no matter how much we try to convince them to return back, that they will return. People of Sudan have opted to return because they had hope, and now we are seeing that with the continuous attacks on the states that we even consider safe, or partially safe, or relatively safe, that they have opted to return voluntarily, they might not feel the same level of safety that they had a couple of months ago, let alone the lack of services that we are all aware about. Water, electricity, basic healthcare services are all almost absent. So if we see a new wave of large displacement within Sudan, this will go definitely more protracted, and it will definitely go beyond Sudan, and it would have its regional impact. My last message is half of those new displacements that we saw from Kordofan are children. It's alarming. It's alarming for the future of Sudan and for the situation we see here. My last message is people in Sudan are not moving by choice. They are running just to find safety. So we count on all member states. We count on everyone who can provide support for Sudan to provide them safety. Thank you. And again, it's a pleasure to be with you all.
Thank you very much, Mohammed, for this update. The situation continues to be extremely, extremely dire. And before I give the floor to the journalists, just would like to remind everybody that with just a couple of weeks to go until the end of the year, The humanitarian response plan for Sudan is only 36% funded, with 1.5 billion received out of the 4.2 billion required. We urgently call on donors to step up support, to close the funding gap and sustain life-saving assistance. And I open the floor to questions now in the room, if there are any hands up. So let's go to the platform. John Zarokostas, France 24, and The Lancet.
Yes, good morning. I've got a question for the spokesperson on the podium. I was wondering, and it's relevant to Sudan, given the big cuts in your budget announced in the closed-door meeting of the council, I think last week, which programs are you cutting back drastically, and does that include Sudan? Does that include Libya? Which countries are you cutting back, and which are you trying to limit cutting back because of the urgency of the needs?
You want to answer, or you want to make
I'd like to have Dr. Mohammed
ask. Yeah. So we'll ask Mohammed to maybe answer, but I don't know if he can only answer for Sudan or in general for the other programs. Mohammed?
Yeah, I think your question is mainly about the overall IOM budget cuts. I can talk about Sudan, and I can tell you that since this year, we have lost almost 83 million of our funding. And this figure had led that we have to reduce our capacity on the ground massively. And because of this, we have went also through many of our advocacy plan with our non-traditional donors, and we managed to get some level of solidarity. But I will go through the solidarity that we got, but let me first remind you that because of those cuts, we have to choose which lives we can save and which support we have to stop. So we would go crossing places where we know that people are absolutely in dire needs, but we will leave them and not be able to help them because we have to prioritize those who are absolutely dying. We have managed to survive our displacement tracking metrics because it's one of the programs that's all the humanitarian systems counting on when it comes to needs assessment and number of displacement. We are keeping our common pipeline for non-food items and shelter items up and running and active because of the generous support we're still getting from different member states. But also we have to reduce our support to many of the local NGOs, NGOs, many of the grant management programs that we were providing, health projects, mobile clinics have closed. And we have to let go a couple of hundreds of colleagues from our workforce. But also we have a glimpse of hope. So I would see that the UNAID and the UNRSS is really a good. We have here good examples that how we made this work in Sudan. And if you allow me in 1 minute, I will give you the story of the donation just received. So the government of Turkey and Emmy Top was here like 3 months ago, 3 weeks ago, and she was in our empty warehouse for our shelter items. And she made a call for all member states to support us. We received several responses to this call. One of them was from the Turkish government, in-kind donation of 30,000 tents. But also we received support from the Sudan Humanitarian Fund to ship this kind of in-kind donation from Turkey to here. And we are working with other NGOs and NGO partners and the Sudanese authority on the distribution to the last miles in Tawila, in areas impacted in Kordofan. So we have managed somehow to, and of course we got also some US government money to support the transportation within Sudan. So this is a good example where we are really getting all the elements from non-traditional donors to traditional donors, to the UN system, to other OCHA supporting, to our working with NGOs, NGOs to get the system work together. The last thing is that this is definitely not enough, and we are responding to an increasing need. As you saw, the needs shifted from 27 million to 33 million this year compared to 27 last year. So the needs are increasing and the resources are less, but we are definitely getting better in working things. But we are far from matching the needs who are just resurging on the ground, especially protection. Thank you.
Thank you. Avan, on other crises?
To push. Mm-hmm. Thank you. As my colleague Mohammed mentioned, unfortunately, the situation is not only unique to Sudan. We face similar challenges in a lot of other countries, Libya included, where you know needs continue increasing, and we are extremely stretched when it comes to resources, unfortunately. And this means that we will have to prioritize even within the groups that are who are most vulnerable, and that unfortunately means that a lot of people who need critical assistance are not going to be able to receive it. And so we continue to appeal to the international community to step up its support and ensure that these crises are not forgotten. I mentioned Libya, there's also protracted displacement crises in a lot of other places like Yemen. We continue also having crises also in countries that are impacted by the impacted by disasters. I think that's all from my side. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Agnes, AFP.
Yes, thank you. It's a question concerning the cuts, 83 million cuts you have mentioned for the funding for Sudan. How much of these, if you could specify the percentage of the decrease that were that can be associated with which country? I mean, which countries, main countries, decided to cut the funding? Is it the US, the main one, or others? If you could specify that. And then I have other questions, but on other related issues and to other organizations. Thank you.
Mohammed, or you want to take that?
Yes.
Maybe Mohammed.
No, I can take
that. Specifically yeah, sure. On Sudan, and I can.
You have to. It's on. Okay. Mohammed, on the Sudan part of it, of the question.
Yeah, definitely. No, definitely. We had, before I respond on the percentage, let's also remember that the overall global appeal for the Sudan response is only around 33 or 30. Slightly above 30% funded. We are almost at 35% funded. And from the cuts that we got, it was, as you know, there are several member states who have reduced, who has decided to reduce their external contribution or review them, including the US and other member states. The biggest chunk for IOM was definitely the US government, but also we saw later on an activation of a percentage of this fund. And most recently also to be very, let's say not very optimistic, but we see glimpse of external support coming. So we received also another, maybe around like good percentage of around 9 million to support us with the shelter items and non-food items. But this is leave the shelter cluster at a gap of around maybe 87%. So the whole shelter cluster in the UN now is between 11% and 12-13% funded, which is a huge gap, even compared to the other clusters within Sudan. So you see other health cluster, WASH, food, are maybe around the 30%, 40%, 50% funded. The shelter, which is the main thing that people who are recently displaced, remains the most, I would say, underfunded in Sudan currently.
Again, a lot of these crises remain severely underfunded, as my colleague Mohammed mentioned, and there's been a general trend that unfortunately we've been noticing, which is the funding decline from a lot of the member states. But we continue to work closely with the donors and also our member states and partners to advocate that these crises are not forgotten. Because it's more important than ever that we continue supporting these people in need to prevent further escalation in the region. Thank you. Over.
Emma, Reuters.
Good morning. I was wondering if you can tell us
who was actually fighting in Kordofan. I'd seen reports that the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North is also involved, as well as obviously the RSF and the Sudanese army. And there's also increasing talk of mercenaries, Colombians. I'm wondering if any of the displaced people have been able to testify. And in your view, how likely is it that El Obeid, I hope my pronunciation is okay, will fall, and what would be the impact of that? Thank you.
Mohammed?
Yeah, thanks. Absolutely, I have no data who's fighting there. We know definitely that it's the traditional actors in this area. But who's fighting where is not part of the data that we collect. But I can tell you that for us, Kadugli, we estimate that there is around 90 to 100,000 people in this area who will be displaced if something happens, if the fighting continue, if they get access to leave the city. In Al Obayid, which seems to be also maybe one or two steps from being the next city under attack, that we estimate more than 500,000 are already going to be impacted. As you have seen also recently, the attack on UNESFA base, it's also another area where we are very alarmed about the trends of attacks and hostilities, even on UN infrastructures. It definitely led also to casualties within the UNESFA soldiers, which we are very concerned and deeply sad about it. So it's also another trend that we need to remind everyone that respect of human rights and principles of engagement need to be very well considered in this kind of conflict. So this is what we know in terms of the impact of the displacement in the areas where the fighting might be escalating over the next days. When it comes to our preparedness, we are actually working in areas where we think the population will be displaced. So near White Nile, Kordofan, White Nile, Gadaref, and we're scaling up our presence there, hoping that we're not needed. But all the signals show that the displacement is just on the rise.
Thank you very much. Maybe just on the human rights side, let me remind you that yesterday the Office of the High Commission for Human Rights called there was a report that was published. They called for an impartial, thorough, and effective investigation into the attack on the Zamzam internally displaced person camp in April. The report detailed widespread killings, rape, and other forms of sexual violence, torture, abductions committed during the three-day offensive. And High Commissioner Turk said those responsible for serious violations of international law be held accountable through fair proceedings. And you can have more on this report from our colleagues at OHCHR. I still have a question from John, and then Agnes, I haven't forgotten, you had something else to ask. So maybe John.
Yes, it's a follow-up to what Mr. Mohammed just mentioned. I think I heard you correctly. You said only about 11 to 13% of the shelter cluster in the UN is funded for all the areas where you have the lead. I was wondering if you see divergences, for instance, the shelter that you're providing for Palestinians in Gaza, are you managing to get the supplies in? And how many supplies have you gotten in? And are there areas where you're having problems getting your supplies in, either because of customs problems or political problems? Thank you.
Because my percentage is for Sudan. This is a shelter of Sudan, not the shelter for globally, not the global shelter cluster. So if it's about Sudan challenges with the shelter, I think it would be definitely number one is the funding. And second, definitely we have access. And access here, I can divide it into logistical access, where as you can look at the Sudan map, it's huge. The road conditions are very bad, the floods. So bringing shelter items, whether to deliver it cross-border or cross-line, is a quite a logistic challenge, and definitely the bureaucratic impediments that we all see. And just to give you one example, we have when Al-Fashr started, like on the 25th, we anticipated that there will be extra need for shelter items. So on the 20th of October, we sent our trucks with tents, with non-food items. And it took them three weeks plus to arrive in Tawilo. And this is still one movement within Sudan itself. There were stoppage at the checkpoints. There were delays at checkpoints. And OCHA, Tom Fletcher, has to intervene to release the blockages. So this is the kind of challenge that we have, and we have to work around the clock to make it happen. So I cannot comment on Gaza, unfortunately, but maybe my colleague in the podium can answer on this.
Yes, and on the problem of access in other countries.
Thank you. With regard to Gaza, as you are aware, it's currently actually experiencing winter storms and heavy rainfall. And so IUMN partners are responding, but without urgent and restricted access, life-saving shelter assistance cannot reach people at scale. So we continue to advocate for unrestricted access to make sure that these needs are met. I can also mention that IUMN and partners are delivering tents and also shelter materials to displaced families in Gaza. But again, with heavy rains, as we've been seeing over the last few days and weeks, high-quality emergency shelter is more urgent than ever right now.
Thank you very much. Let me see if... Oh, John, you have another follow-up?
Yes, thank you for that information. I just need a clarification of the supplies that earmarked by EMA, by IAM and its partners. Are you getting the supplies in, or are you having problems of clearance of the goods going into Gaza? What percentage of the goods that you're requesting to go in are getting in, especially on the shelter? What percentage of the needs that you're...
Thank you very much. I don't have the exact number at hand at the moment, but I'm happy to circle back and get back to you on this one bilaterally. But again, overall, as I said, we do have access issues, and we continue to advocate for unrestricted access.
Thank you very much. I don't see other hands up. And yes, I don't know to whom you wanted to ask your other questions. Or you have found the solution?
No, I need to ask the question, thank you. But not to IOM.
Ah, okay.
So it would be to WHO. And,
okay. No, we still have another speaker from FAO to whom I'm going now. But I wanted to first thank Mohammed for coming back and updating us on the dire situation in Sudan. Thank you very much. Come back anytime. Good luck with your important, very important work in this dire situation. Thanks for coming, Avand, and for answering the other questions. And let me go now. We stay in Africa today. We are remaining on the African territory continent to talk about another crisis in Eastern Africa. We have with us Aki, I think she's online, and Cyril Ferron, who is the FAO Resilience Team Leader for Eastern Africa, who's joining from Nairobi. So you wanted to tell us about the poor rainfall season in the Horn of Africa. You've got the floor.
Thanks a lot, and good morning, everyone. Let me start maybe with the three top messages, and I will unpack them a little bit. So the first message, indeed, is that the Horn of Africa is facing a severe drought. The region has received less than 60% of the normal rain for the end of the year. That's the first message. The second message is that we already see impact on food security. It's already visible, and we also witness people leaving the worst drought hit areas in Somalia and crossing into Ethiopia. The third message is that responding to a drought is about implementing the right set of actions at the right time of the drought cycle. And at the moment, the right set of actions is related to protecting livelihood assets, agriculture, and that's what basically we need to focus on for the moment. So these are the top three messages, but I will unpack them a little bit now. So on the rainfall situation, as I said, the October-December 2025 rainy season has essentially failed across the Eastern Horn of Africa. And the worst affected areas, as I said, on average 60% below of normal rains, but the worst affected areas have received less than 30% for some areas, which means no effective rainfall. And some areas are also witnessing basically driest season on record, and record is basically starting in 1981. In many areas as well, it's not the first season that is failing, it's the second and sometimes the third season, and communities have barely recovered from the past drought. The last drought was 2020-2023. So that's on the rainfall situation. The immediate impact is very clear. Widespread crop failure in Somalia, very low yield expected in part of Kenya as well. We see deteriorating livestock conditions, reduced milk production, and we anticipate livestock deaths in the coming few months. In terms of displacement, there are already 185,000 people that have left or that have moved away from the drought-hit areas of Somalia, and about 56,000 of them have crossed into Ethiopia. And that Somalia has already declared drought emergency on November 10th, and we know that Kenya is reviewing the situation this week. In terms of projected consequences for early 2026, as I said, we are already starting from a caseload that is very high already. We have 2.1 million people severely food insecure in Kenya, 4.4 million people severely food insecure in Somalia. And these analyses preceded the current rainy season failure. So obviously the number are going to increase, and additional population is likely to reach emergency, which is IPC phase four, in the coming few months. This will go also with a rise in malnutrition, spread in livestock diseases, increase potentially gender-based violence and resource-based conflict. What we need to do now, as I said, the right action at the right time of a drought cycle. So what is clear is that a drought should not necessarily translate or become a large multifaceted humanitarian crisis. We need to reduce the impact, and basically we need to focus on livelihood intervention. Because the first impact on the drought is on food production and livelihood. So we need to mitigate the impact as soon as possible. We must maintain food production at household level and reduce losses of assets, especially livestock. And this goes through animal feed, animal health intervention, water intervention. We also must provide financial means for people to buy food until basically they can resume normal production patterns. Unfortunately, at the moment, the funding is not specific to the Horn of Africa, but the funding is very, very scarce. The funding against the 2025 humanitarian appeal is significantly below normal figures. As far as FAO is concerned, we have received across the Eastern Africa region about 20-25% of the funding requirement. And in response to the drought, we are doing, of course, we are using our reserve fund, the Special Fund for Emergencies and Resilience Activity, which is FERA. We have already basically allocated $4 million to the countries for them to implement anticipatory action. We are applying course correctors and crisis modifiers, but definitely as the drought is unfolding, this is not going to be sufficient. So as I said, in summary, we need to act now before the situation further deteriorates and turns into a multifaceted humanitarian crisis. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Cyril. And let me see if there are questions for you in the room. I don't see any hand up. Jérémy Lange, Radio France Internationale, online.
Bonjour, Alessandra. Est-ce que vous m'entendez?
Je t'entends très, très bien. Et j'espère que Cyril t'entend aussi.
Non, mais parfait. Je vais poser la question en français parce que je pense que Cyril Ferrand parle très bien français. Simplement vous faire peut-être répéter ce que vous avez dit, mais est-ce que vous êtes en mesure d'élaborer un peu plus sur, sur le lien qu'on peut faire entre la sécheresse qui touche cette région et la sécheresse des financements, puisque vous le dites très clairement, si on n'a pas d'argent, on ne peut pas acheter de la nourriture pour les animaux pour les empêcher de mourir. Donc très clairement, voilà, vous arrivez à faire ce lien, sécheresse des financements et du coup une aggravation de la situation sur place.
Alors, je crois qu'effectivement, effectivement, il y a un lien de cause à effet dans le sens où on est dans la phase de anticipatory action. C'est vraiment le moment sur les quelques mois qui sont en cours, depuis au moins déjà 2 mois et pour les 3-4 prochains mois, on est dans une phase où on a encore la possibilité de réduire l'impact ou de ralentir la détérioration de la situation. C'est-à-dire... En assurant effectivement qu'on puisse garder du bétail productif pour que le lait qui soit produit puisse aller principalement aux enfants de moins de 5 ans, pour qu'effectivement on arrive à donner du fourrage bétail, pour qu'on arrive effectivement à donner de l'eau également hein, au bétail. Si on échoue dans ce travail-là, alors on va avoir effectivement au-delà des manifestations de sécurité, d'insécurité alimentaire. On va avoir des manifestations qui seront nutritionnelles, on va avoir des populations qui vont se déplacer. Et quand les populations se déplacent, il y a tous les risques qui sont liés au déplacement de population. Donc c'est ça qu'on veut essayer d'éviter au maximum, c'est de ralentir, de prévenir et de ralentir. À l'heure actuelle, il est clair que les financements ne sont pas suffisants pour les actions anticipatoires qui seraient nécessaires à l'heure actuelle. Et donc, malheureusement, on s'oriente vers plus de populations affectées, plus de vulnérabilité, plus de fragilité, plus de déplacements. Et donc, potentiellement, dans le premier trimestre de l'année 2026, une crise qui va être effectivement multifacette avec tout le spectre, je dirais, d'intervention militaire qui va être nécessaire dans un contexte où les ressources vont rester limitées.
Merci beaucoup, Cyril. Est-ce qu'il y a d'autres questions pour les FAO? Je ne vois pas de main levée. Donc, merci beaucoup pour cette information importante sur la situation de la région d'Afrique. Merci pour être venu parler aux journalistes de Genève. Je ne vois pas d'autres questions. Donc, Agnès, tu avais une question pour Tariq.
Oui, j'avais plusieurs questions, en fait, pas que pour l'OMS. Donc pour...
We can see you, Tariq. Go ahead, Agnès.
Yes, so it's not only to Tariq. I have a separate question to other organizations. So the question for WHO, this morning there was a post on social media by Dr. Tedros about the number of people evacuated, medevac, from Gaza. It mentioned 10,000 evacuations since the 7 October. And I was wondering if you could specify how many of them were since the last ceasefire, and if the rhythm of evacuation has accelerated recently or not. And then I will ask the other question, which is to OCHA, to Jens, and the UNHCR on the refugees concerning Venezuela. I would ask to ask you, those organizations, if you are, given the situation and the tensions in the region, if you are preparing any contingency plan, what are you expecting? Are you preparing food or anything? Yes, if you expect on the refugees side any displacements through the borders. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Agnès. So I'll give the floor to Tariq so that he can answer. You maybe ask Jens and Eugene to come to the podium in the meantime. Tariq.
Thank you very much, Agnès. You've seen the post by Director General. I have to really check on exact numbers how many of these evacuations happened since the ceasefire. But yes, there was an increase in medical evacuations. However, more than 18,500 patients, including some 40% of that including 4,100 children still need medical evacuation, and we are calling for countries to accept patients from Gaza, but we also call for medical evacuations to the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, to be restored. As you know, many people were, about 100 per day before the war, were looking for medical care outside, and these routes to West Bank and to East Jerusalem are really vital. So we ask for those routes to be restored. Also, you've seen that according to Ministry of Health, more than 1,000 patients died while awaiting medical evacuations between July 2024 and November 2025, and this is likely underreported and not fully representative, as it's just based on reported deaths. So people are still in Gaza who need to be evacuated and who need to get medical care. We are supporting restoration of health services in Gaza, but it is taking time, and many of these people don't have that time to wait. And that's why we are working on trying to get people out to get medical care they need.
Thank you very much. I see that's what I just wanted. And now let me go to my colleagues here. On Venezuela, is there anything you can share?
Okay, let
you, of course, sorry.
All right, let me start. Without reference to any developments that we are currently seeing, OCHA is constantly monitoring geopolitical situation, economic situation, and so on and so forth anywhere in the world, including Latin America, and preparing accordingly. Having said that, you will also have seen in the global humanitarian overview for next year that across the board, our programs have, you know, for the humanitarian community writ large, has taken a hit, and that has hit Latin America also, generally, with several countries which previously had response plans will not have that next year. That can, of course, change with, as I said, developing situations that require us to get back into the game again, if I can put it like that. Thank you.
I can only echo what Ian said. As a refugee agency, that any displacement situation happening in the region, that we have a staff and supply ready in the region, and then we will be ready to support the government hosting those displacement population, and also be ready to work closely with the hosting country.
Don't go, because John Zarokostas.
Yes, my question is to Tariq. I was wondering, Tariq, can you elaborate a little bit more? You said more than 1,000 people waiting to be medically evacuated have died in the last year or so. Do we know the principal illnesses they were suffering for? Was it predominantly people suffering from cancer, or was it also people with kidney failure, couldn't have access to dialysis machines, etc.? Can you give us the key causes of death, or was it just people with trauma that needed to get out and didn't get out in time?
Tariq?
No, unfortunately, John, I don't have that. And I can try to see with colleagues if we can see. This is the figure that came from the Ministry of Health. And as you know, people who are waiting for evacuation are both people who have sustained trauma injuries due to explosions or bullets, and also those with the chronic diseases. So I don't have really that breakdown.
Thank you very much. Mohamed.
Thank you, Alessandra. My question is also for Tariq. As previous speaker also mentioned, that the cold weather is effective in Gaza, and people also are dying because of that situation. My question is, do you have any data for that? How many people died because of cold weather in this year, Tariq? Thank you.
Again, Mohammed, I'm sorry that I cannot give you exact number how many people died because of a cold weather. There are many many factors that can lead to disease and eventually to death. Obviously, when people are living in a poor hygiene, sanitary conditions, there is increased risk of respiratory diseases, of waterborne diseases, of skin diseases. We have been talking about this throughout the war in Gaza. So what is really needed is to improve the conditions so people have access to clean water, people have access to sanitation, to toilets, and people do not really live in a cold conditions. So all that is making that people are right now with this with floods, with the cold weather and with rain, are more exposed and more at risk of getting disease. And if you really put that on top of that, there is a still issue of availability of proper nutrition in Gaza. It means that people are vulnerable, and especially children and those with pre-existing medical conditions.
Emma?
Yes, just to follow up on that question on Gaza. So hypothermia, people are dying of hypothermia right now. Could you just confirm if that is definitely happening? And on the UNHCR comments on cholera in Burundi and Congo, can you say anything about the scale of that and how concerning it is? Thank you.
Start with you, Tariq.
I will really have to get back to you again. Dr. Pieperkorn was really clear when he was talking here last time that thousands of families are sheltering in these shelters with the debris and with the low level coastal areas. There is no drainage. There is no protective barriers. So what he said, and I repeat that, at least 10 people have reportedly died last week due to heavy rains, underscoring really the life-threatening conditions that families are facing. So I don't have anything further than what Dr. Pieperkorn said to you last Friday, but I may check if we have any new numbers.
And on cholera in Burundi, in DRC, maybe Eugene, you want to say something?
There was indeed a cholera break at the beginning of this year when the armed group moved into Goma. And the problem is that the health facility in IDP sites was destroyed during this first violence. And there is the region that we heard that there is a cholera outbreak, but we cannot access to this region, particularly because of access issue and the blockage, etc. So we're still we're continuing to call all parties to the conflict that unimpeded access of humanitarian to those region to continue to support those people in need is absolutely priority for us. Thanks.
Thank you. I see Ricardo has put his hand up. Ricardo, you have more maybe on Gaza for children?
Hi, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. Yes, very quickly on children who've been suffering with the horrendous weather and cold and displacement and the floods in Gaza. We have seen reports that in December up to now, 3 children have died of hypothermia, including yesterday, a 29-month-old child, a baby who couldn't endure the disease and the cold temperatures and the lack of medical infrastructure and medicines and support to help her survive. So that the baby died 29-month-old of hypothermia. That's the 3rd reported child who dies in December in Gaza. Thank you.
Thank you. That's horrific. Iman.
Thank you so much. This is a question for Tariq, actually. Do you have any information about the cholera outbreak in Gaza or other disease in Gaza? And the second question about the medical evacuation. I know the priority is to treat this patient, but when you have like a permission for the medical evacuation, do you have also any guarantee that those people could return their home after the war? And because since that Israel is facilitating the transfer of patients to other countries, but it doesn't allow them to go to hospital in the West Bank or Jerusalem, for example. Thank you.
Thanks. I don't have any information about any potential cholera cases. We have put in place, as Dr. Pipercon explained, the early warning alert and response system, and this was put in January 2024, which is basically surveillance system to look for diseases. Obviously, if people don't have access to clean water, there is a risk of waterborne diseases. And now that people are in this in a poor water and sanitation conditions, there is a risk of diarrheal diseases as well as a hepatitis and, as I said, respiratory diseases. So when it comes to medical evacuation, basically the process is that every patient is looked by health professionals, and it's being looked if the care can be provided or not, and then we look at which countries are willing to accept the patient, and that's the process. Now it really comes up to you should ask really countries who are accepting patients what is their policy of keeping them or for how long and what are the possibilities for to come back. Our really job is to help advocate for patients to get that treatment. And again, as I said, we really need to restore those referral pathways that we had before to East Jerusalem, to West Bank, but also both also to Egypt, and try really to save as many lives as possible. But again, I can speak about medical side of it, but not on the right of return and how that is being done.
Thank you very much, Tariq. I don't see other hands up, so thank you to the colleagues for this additional information. I don't have final announcements for you, but a little bit of a logistical information. First of all, I like to point out that we have just issued the special edition of the ONU Info Genève, that, as you know, is our podcast in French that we publish thanks to our colleagues and our interns at the end of each week. And we have a recap for 2025, which I found extremely interesting. So I wanted to point you to listen to it. I hope you listen to it all the time, but this one is particularly interesting. As you know, this is the last briefing of the year. Unless something happens, that we are always ready to bring you back here if needed. But otherwise, the next briefing will be on the 6th of January, 2026, briefing of the new year. You have been receiving from Solange the list of the focal points who are on duty during this period, and I take the opportunity to thank Solange for the support that she's given to the briefings all this year. And I know you have all counted on her, both spokesperson and journalist, to help us with this. So thank you very much, Solange, and Ali, of course, because he also helped. Just to remind you that the Palais remains open at the usual conditions, that is that you can come in when you need. But if you come on weekends or on holidays, which will be basically the 25th of December and the 1st of January, you have to go through me or Rolando or Michele or the person who are on duty. Other things that are closed, there are quite a few of them. The bookshop closes today, will reopen on the 5th of January. The Chemin de Fer, you're always asking about the accesses. The Chemin de Fer closes today at 2 o'clock and will reopen on also on the at the end of the first week of January. The cafeteria is going to be closed from the 24th to the 5th. Bar Concordia will sustain us, will continue to sustain us, except 25th, 26th, and 1st of 2nd of January. I think I've told you more or less everything on the logistics. I think so. The SAF is also closed on the 24th on the 24th and reopen on the 3rd of January, well, on the 5th. So that is what I had for you. If there are no questions, I don't see hands up. Let me see on the platform now. So I'm left to thank you all very, very much for your coverage, for your support, for your cooperation during this year, both journalist and colleague spokesperson. It hasn't always been an easy year, but as the Director General said, it's been interesting. We've done incredibly important things during this year. I'm sure that will be the case also next year. So I wish you all and your dear ones a very happy holiday and a serene new year. And I'll see you on the 6th of January. For another interesting and challenging, but definitely hope, let's hope, good year. Thank you.